So the next speaker is Coralie Chevalier from the École Normale Supérieure about acceptability of large-scale prevention measures.
Thank you so much for having me. I think this is, again, a great transition from Kathleen's talk. So over the past three decades, a number of reasons have been put forward to explain the absence of behavioral change to address climate change.
Closer to the microphone.
Yes. Is this better like this? Or maybe I should shout? Yeah? Is it better like that? Okay. It's just that I wanted to see my notes. Let me reorganize this. Here. And the time. Okay. And the resulting common view is that climate change is hard to address. So I'm talking here about the behavioral perspective, people who, like me, do behavioral science, cognitive science, psychology. And people have argued that there's a range of reasons why people are not taking action. One of them is time discounting, risk perception, and things like that. And so the resulting common view is that climate change is hard to address because it's complex, it's long-term, it's a diffused phenomenon. In other words, there's a sort of suspicion that the reason why people are not acting is that they don't really get it. And I think there's a big issue with this narrative, because in fact, the majority of people now believe that climate change is happening, and this is especially true in Europe. We don't have a high level of climate change skepticism. And they think that more should be done to curb CO2 emissions. To give just one statistic, in Europe, for instance, 93% of Europeans see climate change as a serious threat, and they agree that we should really do everything we can to curb CO2 emissions. So it's not the case that people don't really understand the issue. But despite the increasing level of climate change awareness, mitigation efforts are disappointing. And people often fail to adopt behaviors that would be impactful, such as saving home energy or reducing air travel. To take just one example, the share of SUVs has risen sharply, despite the fact that they are the second source of increase in CO2 emission in the world, right behind the energy sector and in front of heavy industry or aviation. So if you just want to have a quick reference point, if all SUV drivers joined to form a single country, it wouldn't be a very nice country. But if they did, it would be the seventh largest CO2 emitting nation in the world. So just to give you an order of magnitude. And what's interesting about SUVs is that the choice of driving an SUV or not driving an SUV is entirely up to the individual. It's a purely individual choice. So it's puzzling that we see both an increased awareness and such a big increase in choice, individual choices that run against the logic of fighting CO2 emissions. So the question is the following. Given the high level of concern around climate change, what is keeping people from adopting behaviors or supporting policies that effectively reduce CO2 emissions? I want to argue that part of the issue, and this is because that's what I work on, it's not the only source of explanation, but part of the explanation is the social dimension of climate change, and Kathleen alluded to this as well, and that partly accounts for slow behavioral change. But I want to provide an optimistic message, which is that part of the issue is social, and understanding the social nature of the issue is also the beginning of the solution. So climate change is a large-scale collective action problem where outcomes are shared, but the cost of behavioral change is often individual. So to curb climate change, people have to cooperate. That's the very definition of cooperation. A corporation is resisting the urge of free riding on the sacrifices of others while enjoying collective benefits. So we're facing the very definition of cooperation. Now, one might initially think that the very nature of humans, which is our species, is inherently social, that this should be helpful to curb climate change. Humans are extraordinary in the quantity and in the quality of cooperative interactions in which they engage on every scale and in every domain. And what we're doing actually just today is an example of such cooperative behavior. You know, we're trying to put all knowledge and disciplines together to solve an issue that will benefit society. Okay, science is a large-scale cooperation endeavor. But humans are not blind altruists. They have not evolved to be maximally generous. None of us tries at every given time point to be as generous as possible. That is not the definition of cooperation. Cooperation can only evolve if it is conditional. And this is what people working in evolutionary biology have shown. The stability of cooperation depends on whether or not cooperation is conditional. So in their interactions with others, humans don't seek to be as generous as possible. Rather, they seek to contribute at the right level, no more, no less. And the reason why this is evolutionarily stable is that those people who put in too much effort in the very long history of the human species ended up being exploited. If you're too generous, you're exploited. So evolutionarily speaking, it is not a stable strategy. And on the contrary, if you don't put in enough effort in collective endeavors, then people won't like you, and you will not be included in collective actions in which you could have gained individual benefits, okay? So very naturally, as it were, in the literal sense of naturally, very naturally, in the long history of human evolution, given the fact that we are a species that cooperates a lot and gains a lot of benefits from cooperation, the psychology that we have evolved is a psychology that seeks to cooperate conditionally at the right level, no more, no less, okay? So we seek to put in just enough effort so that individuals engaged in cooperation benefit equally. And when I'm saying this, I realize that you might be thinking that this is all very cynical. But what I'm describing is a mechanism, is not what it feels, okay? It's a bit like love. When we love someone, we don't love someone in order to pass on our genes by sexually reproducing with that person, okay? Love is the product of a mechanism that ultimately makes the human species reproduce. But when we love someone, we don't love someone with, at the back of our head, the necessity to pass on our genes, okay? So it's a little bit the same. When we cooperate sincerely, authentically, but the evolutionary reason why we cooperate the way we cooperate is that, okay? Now, the pressure to cooperate, I want to argue, is selected a number of psychological mechanisms, features, that I think are really important to understand both issues with climate change mitigation and potential solutions. So I'm going to highlight three: norm detection, reputation management, and fairness computation. Okay, I want to start with norm detection, and for each I'm going to provide evidence showing how this is both a problem for climate change mitigation and the beginning of a solution, we hope. So the overall point is that the cognitive mechanisms that are involved in regulating cooperation do not necessarily lead to the most effective outcome from a societal standpoint. And that's the problem that our psychology is creating, okay? Our psychology is regulated by mechanisms that did not evolve to make sure that society works perfectly and that utility is maximized. Our psychology evolved in part, when we talk about the social world, to cooperate in a way that's efficient. Okay. So to start with social norms, the idea is that to contribute to a collective effort, people need to have sufficient evidence that others will also take action. And in fact, people's perception of the right thing to do very much depends on what others are doing. And you see, that's a problem for climate change, and it's a problem for a range of situations in which the current social norm isn't the norm that we need to make progress. So the reason why that is the case is that, and that's why there's a smoke detector on this slide, the reason why that is the case is that it's more adaptive to beware and to make sure that you're not investing too much rather than the opposite. So there's a cost of making the mistake of assuming that others are going to cooperate when in fact perhaps they won't cooperate. So there's an asymmetry between making a mistake where you cooperate too much versus making a mistake where you cooperate not enough. And so what we see when we look at what people think about others' investment, and this is very robust across a range of collective action problems, is that people tend to underestimate the likelihood that others are investing at the right level, okay? And that creates a vicious circle, because if you anticipate that others are not investing in the collective good, then you have less of an incentive to yourself invest in the collective good. And this creates situations that are called, for example, pluralistic ignorance, which is a situation in which people privately reject a norm, but they engage with it because they falsely assume that most others accept it. Let me give you an example. This is an example in a domain that is unrelated to climate change, but I thought it was interesting to mention this paper that I think is an excellent paper. It's a paper that it's a field study, a randomized controlled trial in Saudi Arabia, where researchers were interested in why women work from home and are prevented by their husbands to work outside the home. And what they did is that they recruited women, they recruited husbands, and they asked them whether they thought that women should be allowed to work outside the home. And what they found is that most husbands actually agree that women should be allowed to work outside the homes. And then they randomized those husbands into two groups. One group in which they provided no additional information, and another group in which they simply told them that most husbands agree that women should be working outside the home. And then the women of those husbands were offered to sign up on a job matching platform, and they measured whether the husbands were willing to sign up their wives on the job matching platform, and whether this had an actual impact on women's ability to work. And what they found is that, indeed, by lifting pluralistic ignorance, by telling the husbands that most other males in Saudi Arabia actually agree that women should be allowed to work, this had an impact on the probability that women were signed up on the platform, and ultimately on their ability to find a job. So I think it's a really interesting case where you see that part of the inaction can be caused by false beliefs that others are not willing to act, when in fact they are willing to act. Norm credibility is another factor that really guides people's acceptance of social norms. So credibility comes both from the source that's promoting the social norm and from the content of the norm. There's now a lot of evidence that for example, community organizers who themselves install a solar panel and then go on to talk to people to encourage them to install a solar panel are more likely to convince residents to install a solar panel. In other words, one of the issues with social norms is that the people promoting the social norm need to themselves be leaders and show the right example, which isn't always the case in decision makers who promote those norms. Now, this is a problem because it creates a bootstrapping issue. The bootstrapping issue is that people only respond to norms that are already prevalent, by definition. So what can we do when we want to promote a norm that isn't prevalent yet? For example, not driving alone. That's not a norm that's already prevalent. Most people drive alone. Or reducing meat consumption. That's a minority behavior that should be promoted to curb CO2 emissions. So what do you do when you understand that people's behaviors is in part guided by the prevalent norm? What do you do when you're facing a situation where the norm isn't already prevalent? Well, one option is to talk about the dynamic norm. So instead of talking about what's happening right here and right now, giving indication to people about the dynamic of the norm, so where we're headed to. This is a very anecdotal evidence, and I'm sorry because that's the only one I found, on the use of reusable cups. And what's interesting in this experiment is that they tested people in a company where most people used plastic cups and not reusable cups. So the current norm was not the one that was needed. And what they did is that instead of telling workers about the current norm, they said more and more employees are switching from the plastic cup to the reusable cup, which was right. And by sending this message, they found that the proportion of consumers using reusable cups increased by 17% following the intervention. So it's a bit of and I've seen similar results on meat consumption. If you explain to people, if you give information about the dynamic of meat consumption, then more and more people understand that the future is less meat consumption. Okay, reputation is another very powerful social mechanism. And I want to give you a sort of experiment, a psychology experiment, so that you have intuition about the power of reputation. The rationale is that given the high benefit for humans of collective actions, being perceived as a good cooperator for humans is crucial. So not only do we cooperate in a certain way, but we want others to know that we cooperate that way. We want others to be aware that we are not cheaters, okay? It's really important to us. So let me give you, this is a fun experiment by social psychologists, where they manipulated the cost of an image that others would have of you and a cost for yourself. So let me give you an example. The cost is either you'll spend a year in jail, and once you've completed your time in jail, you will no longer be considered... You have to consider the reputation damage. Let me explain. So the reputation damage is you are labeled a criminal by your community, and you have a choice between this or spending time in jail, okay? The most interesting example is the second one, where the reputation damage is that you have a swastika tattooed on your forehead forever, and everyone you meet assumes that you're a Nazi when they see you, and you're not allowed to explain that this was an experiment, including to your friends, your family, strangers. You can't explain why you have this tattoo on your face. Now, the cost that you can choose is that you can choose to die right now. What's really interesting is that half of the people facing that choice say that they prefer to die right now rather than having a tattoo, a swastika tattooed on their face. Let's look at another one. You live into your 90s, but everyone in your community will think you're a pedophile who sexually abuses children, and you will not actually be a pedophile, but you'll have nowhere of proving that you're not. And again, the cost is that you can choose to die right now and be remembered fondly by your community, and 30% of people choose to die right now. This is just it's a fun way of illustrating how powerful our reputation management system is. And the cost I prefer is having your dominant hand amputated. And I'm sure that all of you agree, well, I don't know, I hope all of you agree that having your right hand amputated is preferable to looking like a Nazi to the rest of humanity for the rest of your life. Okay, so we're ready to incur huge costs to protect our reputation. So the consequence of this is that when behaviors can be easily identified as signal of cooperation, people are more likely to engage in them, okay, for better or worse. For better or worse, because the problem with climate change mitigation is that the behaviors that are observable are not necessarily the behaviors that are the most impactful. For example, it's very impactful to insulate your roof, but no one will know you did it. And that is something that people have quantified in the case of car choices. It's called the Prius effect. People are ready to pay more money to buy a Prius because that is observable. Everybody will know that you chose to spend money to get a car that protects the environment. Okay, the British government has tried to use this mechanism by putting a green tag on number plates that for cars that are energy efficient and don't look energy efficient. Okay, so this is a clever way of trying to circumvent the problem. But we have to keep in mind that for many behaviors that are unobservable yet impactful, perhaps subsidies should focus on those. So for example, if the state has the choice between subsidizing solar panels on roof, which is highly observable, versus insulation under the roof, perhaps subsidies should go more to insulation under the roof than to solar panel on top of the roof, okay? People also care about enhancing their value to their social network. We want to appear competent and nice. Now, again, the issue is that sometimes behaviors that are that make us look warm and nice are not the ones that are eco-friendly or impactful. Okay, I'm taking another example here from public health, which is that vaccination and vaccination uptake is often favored by people who, I'm talking about averages here, right? Who don't care as much about like the environment and natural birth and all of those things. On the other hand, amongst parents who are more interested in natural birth, washable nappies, and things like that, there are more anti-vaxxers, okay? So the issue is, if you're part of the community that cares about natural birth and washable nappies, you may be sending a signal that you're not very nice if you vaccinate your children. Do you see the thing? Because you're doing something that goes against the average of your coalition. So this is a very smart campaign, public health campaign, that was actually used by the Australian government, where they demonstrated that actually in the group where people care about washable nappies and natural birth, there are parents who choose to vaccinate their children. And this campaign was evaluated rigorously, and the scientists showed that it had a positive effect on vaccination uptake. Now, broadly speaking, the point that I'm trying to make is that one of the issues that we have with climate change is that the observability isn't a good predictor of impact. And one of the important stakes that we have now is to make impact more observable. And some charities try to do this. For example, The Life You Can Save is a charity that tries to ensure that people understand impact and don't just rely on what's observable and what feels nice, but really what is effective. Okay, the last point that I want to make is fairness. Of course, if we keep in mind that one of our goals is to cooperate, fairness is really important. When engaging in cooperation, People not only decide who they should cooperate with, but also how the costs and benefits of cooperation should be shared. There are two challenges there. One is that people's fairness evaluations are strongly influenced by the status quo. And Kathleen talked about this. Historical emissions are a very good example of the status quo. You know, what should we be taking into account? Who emits currently the most, or who has contributed the most to CO2 emissions? And status quo also has an importance on local decisions. For example, it makes a difference whether you think that the street belongs to everybody and we need to share in a fair way the street, or whether you think that the street currently belongs to car drivers, and adding a bike lane amounts to stealing some space that belongs to car drivers to give it to bike drivers, okay? So depending on the way you frame the situation, you can elicit very different fairness impressions. And the issue for public policies is that people value fairness over effectiveness when they decide between various public policies. And this has been a very important challenge for the carbon tax. People can recognize that it's effective, but given that it's perceived as not fair, there's no way that people can agree on it. So people often value fairness above and beyond the aggregate outcome of a given action, and people's sense of fairness does not favor the most good for the most people. That's not the definition of fairness. The consequence is that most people are unwilling to increase cure rates, for example, for a large group, if it comes at the cost of reducing cure rates for a smaller group. People will favor income distributions that are more equal than those with a higher total income. And most citizens prefer retributive justice to deterrence. And most citizens don't like the carbon tax because it doesn't match what we think is fair. I'm going to skip this because I'm a little late to conclude. So the point I tried to make here is that our evolutionary history has shaped us and calibrated our psychology so that we can evolve in an environment, which is the environment of the human species, where cooperation is key. And this has selected cognitive mechanisms that support cooperation. Norm detection, people underestimate the proportion of cooperators, they're sensitive to the credibility of social norms and so on. Reputation management and fairness computation. Now, those create issues for climate change mitigation, but they're also the beginning, the starting point of a solution. For example, if you make social norms more visible, or if you make sustainable behaviors more visible, or if you include redistributive programs in policies and communicate about their impact. So the point is that to accelerate climate change mitigation, I think that we should work with rather than against people's social instincts. We should recognize that people have those social instincts and implement them straight ahead in the very design of public policies. Sorry for being a little late. Thank you.